Greetings and salutations, everyone. Once again, this is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and this is the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going on since 1982 in one form or another, mostly under the guidance of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key. So we're here every Sunday night. It's Sunday night. It's 8 o'clock, and this is W2VL, as well as the Selden repeater. So I hope everyone has returned with us with a bunch of questions and topics to discuss. Let me mention the usual links before I begin. If you need to contact me and you can't do it by radio, if you want to ask me a mailbag question or suggest a topic of discussion or offer me a puzzle, we're always looking for interesting puzzles for this net. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at some website or YouTube and discuss something that space related, NASA related, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com. I also have a whole bunch of interesting links for you. There are some at the top of the page which don't lend themselves terribly to discussions on the radio, but they're very interesting. They require visual participation. I think the three of them this week are YouTube videos, so I have them on my link page. And in addition, I have a series of articles that, if we go into the Science Talk segment, will be the basis of the articles that I talk about. So the link page is available. You just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the link page. I keep those links up for the foreseeable future. They'll be available at your leisure. If you are interested in a chat room, we do have a chat room. You can either go to Limark's own website and follow the links there, or you can type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. And I always like to remind people of Mike KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv site. It has archives of the technical debt that go as far back as September of 2006. I recently exchanged some emails with Mike. He has passed his 1 millionth visitor to his website. And he tells me that traffic has persisted unabated for the last few years, and he's very pleased, as am I. So please avail yourself of this resource. There's a lot of very useful information from hams that are still with us and hams that are not with us anymore, unfortunately. Silent keys who have passed on their wisdom, but it still remains in our archives. So please, check out amateurradio.tv at your leisure. Let me drop for a second.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, unfortunately, I seem to have timed out the repeater. Let me just mention that MyKC2NJI's Amateur Radio TV is a good archive. It goes back to 2006, September. And he's just had his millionth visitor, and he says that traffic is lively. Unfortunately, all the other nets that he has archived have gone off the air, but the Limark Technical Net remains the one net that still is producing live archives for him on a weekly basis. So that's great. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, so the plan for tonight is simple. We will ask people if they have any questions for the net, comments for the net, observations for the net. If you asked a question at one point and went off and tried some different things and discovered stuff that you'd like to share with us, that would be great. We'll take those down in the order that they're given. You give us your first name and your call sign, and we'll write them down, and we'll get to them one after the other. Don't have any puzzles, unfortunately, for tonight. Couldn't find any interesting enough. So if we have spare time, we'll open it to any kind of technical question. And if we still have time, we'll do some science talk segments. Around 10:15, Paul, WS2N, will give us the SpaceNet report, and then I'll come back at around 11 p.m. to tie it up in a bow. So that's the plan for tonight, if the repeater and my radio are willing and my amplifier is willing. So hopefully that's the way it'll go. So anyone with any questions or comments or topics or such, please give me your first name and your call sign.
WB2AHK, check. WB2KWC, Ken.
Sam, can you 2NFJ?
Okay, very good. Chet, what's your topic or question tonight?
Hello, how you doing? All right? Hello to all the Met members. I'm working on an antenna project, and I have all the materials, but I find that one of my adapters, a metal adapter, won't fit. It needs to be milled, taken to a smaller size. And I don't have the equipment for that. And I'm just wondering, as a question to the members here, does anybody know a ham who's a machinist that has a milling machine so that I can get the project going? That's pretty much my question. Roy, go ahead.
Okay, Chet, that's a good question. You know, in the old days, I would tell you to talk to Eric because he had all of those tools. He had lots of interesting gadgets to play with. He had CNC equipment and such. But I open it to the rest of you guys. Do you know anyone who has access to a milling device?
The Pelagian CDL, I have a lathe, if that'll work.
Okay, what about that, Chet?
Hi, Andy. How you doing, Andy? No, it's not round. Lathe is no good. It's not cylindrical. It's square. It's a 2.5-inch square tube, 12 inches long, that I have to take off around 1/32 on each side. And I tried sanding it down, but that's impossible. It's 60-61 aluminum. So a milling machine would be able to do that. So, but thanks anyway, Andy. Back to the net.
Okay, thanks, Andy. Once again, anyone out there either have a milling machine that they could lend some time on, or knows a fellow ham or a friend that might be available to help Chet out in this.
Okay, thanks, Roy. I'll keep looking. I'll have to try to find a machinist. You know, there's not machinist place around as much as there used to be 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I think they're all involved in large projects. And for me, a ham to bring a little piece like that might be inconvenient for those companies that are still left in the business. Not too many. But thanks to the net. Thank you anyway. Appreciate it. That she comes to you. Net Control, Roy, WB2AHK. Keep up the good work.
WHCDL, Chet, give me a call, but not tonight. Or I'll call you, because I know people who have it. I may be able to get it done at work also.
Thanks, Andy. Okay, I will do that. I won't bother you tonight. I'll be in touch with you. Very good. That's a good lead. I am very happy. That's wonderful. Thanks very much, WB2AHK.
Okay, I just got back to New York. I was away in the Midwest. See you later. I'm going to go eat. Roy, back to you, W8-2CD. I'm leaving the call. I'm at the restaurant.
Okay, enjoy your dinner, Andy.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
I think I double a lot here through Salvin. Anyway, before anybody said anything, I was going to recommend a grinder. If it's, you know, a regular grinding machine, I don't know how perfect it has to be, but, you know, it's only 1/32nd of an inch. And grinder, you can put that thing in a vise and, you know, put marks around it and just, you know, get it down to, you know, down to your mark, unless it's, you know, some kind of really super precise fit. You know, you can get it pretty square. You know, you don't need a big hand grinder, a small one, you know, with a 3.5-inch disc on it. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, Chet, how precise does this cut need to be, by the way?
Yeah, I've tried that already. I actually have a grinding machine with a belt, and it hardly takes off anything with 80 grit. It's 60-61 hard aluminum, and I even pretty much burned out the motor, 1/3 horsepower motor on the machine. It's still working, but I think one of the wires is shorting out inside the motor because it got so hot. I tried putting a fan on the motor when I was using it. No, it doesn't work. It has to be very, very precise, extremely precise. It's not something that I can do. I already tried already. So it has to be somebody that knows what they're doing with a milling machine. And they're going to have to look at the piece that I'm making has to fit inside two other pieces. Both ends have to go into another piece. And it has to be not a slip fit, not a sloppy fit. It has to be exact, extremely exact. So looks like it's time for a professional, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, very good, Chet. I kind of thought it might be like that because it sort of sounded the way you presented it. How much you have to shave down wasn't exact number. So, you know, it's a shame that we don't have, you know, a bunch of people who are into this and have their garages or their basements full of this equipment. I watch a whole bunch of YouTubes at times, and every so often some of these people who make these very interesting gadgets do a run through their shop. And they have all these esoteric, somewhat expensive pieces of equipment. But, you know, those guys are few and far between. But, you know, hopefully Andy will hook you up with someone who will be able to do it for you. So think optimistically, and we'll see what happens.
Roger that. Thank you very much. I have hope. WB2AHK.
Very good. Okay, next on my list is Ken, WB2KWC. What's your question or topic tonight, Ken?
Okay, if you recall, a few weeks ago I had a problem with a haunted television. For some reason, the television kept on turning itself on. There were a bunch of suggestions, basically hide the remote in another room to see if there's an issue with the remote. And I had been playing around with different solutions. The TV was hooked up to a TiVo, and there was some question about whether the TiVo was activating the CEC to turn on the television. So I tried turning off the TiVo. And basically, after leaving the TiVo unplugged for about a day, the problem has gone away. So the good news is my TV is no longer mysteriously turning itself on. The bad news is I don't understand what the problem was.
Okay, now you plugged back the TiVo and it still doesn't turn itself on? Or you haven't plugged the TiVo back in?
Yeah, No, the TiVo has been plugged in for quite a while, and it's not, causing any problems. Previous to that, I had rebooted the TiVo a number of times, but whatever it is, apparently, I don't know if there was something in the TiVo that was just retaining a charge and keeping up. I'm not sure why, but leaving it off for a long period of time, basically after that, the problem went away. I'm not going to say it fixed it, but the problem went away after that.
Okay, as the saying goes, all's well that ends well. I never owned a TiVo. I had their, I think it was Replay TV. That was their, the other company that got into that business. I'm familiar with set-top boxes have always been a little peculiar. I had Dish DirecTV, and it had an interesting feature. If you unplugged it for a while and then replugged it, it kind of lost its memory or something and went back to Papa to download the latest, greatest firmware. So maybe there's some aspect of the TiVo receiver that if you keep the power down for a while and it wakes up and realizes it, it refreshes its BIOS or something. So maybe that's what was going on, and there was some corrupt code in the in its memory that just kept on occasionally kicking in a CEC, you know, TV turn on signal that was inappropriate.
That is possible. Basically, I went to the configuration of the television, and I turned off CEC. So, theoretically, it shouldn't have responded to the signal, even if it received one.
Oh, well, maybe it's some kind of innate problem that never was obvious to you because you never had any piece of equipment that tried to access the CEC protocol. So, you know, maybe that part of your TV was kind of always malfunctioning, you know, something in the firmware or something. Who knows? But, you know, at least, thankfully, your problem has solved itself. It's not as rewarding as definitively knowing what caused it and having reversed it. I had somewhat a similar problem with a computer where I did 3,000 things and it just kind of fixed itself. You know, I even talked to a technician and they didn't even have a clue how it fixed itself. So, you know, not quite as rewarding, but ultimately better it should fix itself and you not quite know what the hell went on than it not fix itself.
Yes, it's better that the problem isn't there, but I'm the kind of person that likes to know why something, and this is something that I don't know why. So, I don't know, there's a little portion of my brain that says, how come it's working?
Yeah, I'm quite similar. I really like to know why things either do things or don't do things. And getting back to my computer problem, it was, for some odd reason, I rebooted it, and rather than go into Windows, it went into the BIOS setup screen. So I saved the BIOS, and at that point, it kept on having a loop. It would go into the BIOS, start to go into Windows, crash, go back into the BIOS, go into Windows at the very beginning, crash, and it would just loop-de-loop over and over again. I disconnected everything. I pulled everything apart. And the thing that might have been the thing that did it, that fixed it, is that I unplugged the computer entirely rather than just cutting the power down. I relieved it of all electricity and left it like that overnight. So, you know, maybe, you know, very much like yours, maybe it was just letting it kind of drain its capacitors and such, caused it to reboot and rethink what it was doing and come up with a better solution. Who knows?
Yeah, well, at least it's, you know, at least you can boot it. I would possibly run SpinRite or something on that hard drive just to see if there's some diagnostics, if it, you know, if the problem was a hard drive issue.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Ken, do you have something called Stream 4K associated with that TiVo?
No, I'm Stream 4K is unfamiliar to me. Is it something that interfaces with TiVos, or I plead ignorance.
I did a quick Google search, and a Reddit page came up, and somebody's got a TiVo, and it turns on their TV randomly, and I didn't read the whole thing, but I could email you the link.
Okay, email me the link. I will read it, and maybe it'll provide more satisfaction than it magically stopped behaving badly.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
It's caught the last end of it, so I don't know if it's still, well, what it's doing. It's not booting up. Is that true? It's just not booting up? You get a black screen or a blue screen?
Okay, Rich, we kind of cross wires with my problem versus Ken's problem. My problem was that it would bring up the BIOS. It's a computer problem, not a TiVo problem, my problem. And I solved it. But it went from the BIOS screen to the very, very simple Windows icon that's the preliminary screen when it's calling up Windows files. And then it would hiccup and flash back into the BIOS screen, and it would just keep on doing that dance forever and ever, no matter what I did. I powered it off. I powered it back on. I rebooted. I finally pulled the chassis out, and I thought something was loose, so I pulled a bunch of daughter cards out. I disconnected everything plugged in to the computer, because that can do it. If you remember my story of how my 7100 got screwed up, it was a simple push-to-talk connection that was giving it the problem. That didn't help. So, but that was a separate thing. That's it would just cycle into reboot. And like I said, one of the last few things that I did was disconnect the power supply entirely for a night. And then I plugged it back in. It still actually did that reboot one or two times, but after about three or four, it just kind of all of a sudden took, and thank God it's still taking. So I'm having no problems with my computer, Rich.
There's one thing you didn't disconnect, I don't think either of you did, was take the battery out, open up the side of the computer, and flip out that battery for about 5 minutes, and then put it back in and see what happens.
Yeah, I could have disconnected the BIOS battery. I was a little bit anxious about doing that, unless, you know, someone else kind of told me. I don't know. It didn't strike me as particularly a BIOS problem, or at least not obviously as a BIOS problem, since it shifted over to Windows. So I kind of thought that it was primarily some device was going wacky when it was first being pulled by the initial Windows software, you know, when it first boots up. But that would have been another option, yeah, to pull the battery and to let that sit overnight as well.
Yeah, well, I've never seen pulling a battery make anything worse. only better. So I don't think there's any danger in doing that if it goes back to doing what it does. So at last resort, that's what I do. I don't do it at the last resort because I think I'm going to mess anything up. I do it at last resort because that is the last resort, resetting the BIOS. And this sounds like a BIOS problem to me. Anyway, W2BZ, back to net.
Okay, like I said, all's well that ends well, so that was my conception after the fact that powering it down for a long period of time, that apparently I didn't need to depower the board, the motherboard itself. I just needed to kind of remove any kind of electricity. But, you know, getting back to Ken's problem, I think Lou has been... Oh, Ken's been investigating that it's a TiVo product. It appears to be a kind of a streaming, hardware that's very, Amazon has their Fire, and there are other companies that have these little streaming dongles, but it's just a streaming dongle that's being sold through TiVo. But, you know, if you don't have it, then I don't think you're going to have any side effects from it.
Well, that seems logical. What do you mean by a streaming dongle? A streaming, what, Bluetooth?
No, one of those cute little things that they have. I forget the names of all these different companies, but you know, like Fire, there's a Fire Stick, I think it's called. It's basically an HDMI and a power connector, and it has a built-in Wi-Fi. You plug it into the side of your monitor. And it for television sets that don't have software that allows you to stream Netflix and such, it's a way around that. So I think it's just a branded model for TiVo because TiVo doesn't have any external streaming software by itself. And if you have a very old TV, I guess, that doesn't have streaming software, it's advantageous to get it somehow. So TiVo decided to try and make a couple of bucks off of the product.
It's a little bit more than that.
Oh, okay. Please tell, Ken. I just browse it. It's kind of difficult to read and talk simultaneously.
Okay. TiVo is basically, it's got a hard drive in it. And it's basically a DVR. It's got a program. Now, when I say program, I mean schedule of different, what's on the television. It will record it onto its hard drive. It's got enough intelligence so that you can say, hey, this program comes on every Wednesday at 8 p.m. and lasts an hour. Tune to channel, 7, stuff like that. So it's a DVR with a whole bunch of intelligence, and it's run by, it's basically a Unix computer running a DVR.
Yeah, Ken, but we were talking about that streaming attachment. That attachment is not... as far as I was aware of DVR, I'm familiar with DVRs. Like I said, I had a Replay TV, which was their competitor. So DVRs were curious things. I distinctly recall at the very beginning of this technology trying to explain it to people, and for some odd reason, if you just explained it, they never seemed to get it. If you let them see it in action. They had little epiphanies of, gee, what I could do with that. I could time shift legitimately, not just record stuff on a crappy VHS and maybe, record a couple of shows and that's the end of it. So it was a kind of interesting psychologically, seeing how people responded to digital VRs. But this thing that... Lou was mentioning, it looked to me like a streaming doggle, like a Fire Stick or something like that.
No, this is more than that. Now, the latest version of the TiVos do have the ability to stream things so that I can get Amazon Prime or Netflix or Vudu and a whole bunch of other things which are streaming. But TiVo's origins are the DVR.
Yeah, I understand entirely, Ken. It's just that I believe Lou mentioned the TiVo Stream 4K. And when I pull up the TiVo Stream 4K, it's a $40 item that they describe as streamline your streaming. Your time is valuable. They show Sling. They show Android TV streaming player. And they talk about Netflix and Hulu and otherwise. So, again, I'm thinking that the thing that Lou is mentioning, which is the TiVo Stream 4K, is not an actual TiVo DVR itself, but just a streaming adapter that plugs into the side someplace.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, as I said before, I'm ignorant of the TiVo Stream 4K. I guess I will go look it up and educate myself.
Okay. It looks like a lot of other companies have pretty much the same thing, that this might be slightly better designed to plug directly into a TiVo, or they may tell you to plug it into a TV, who knows, but yeah, check that out. I was just bringing it up simply because Lou was mentioning that he was Googling TiVo's turning things on, and I think he got some hits where they mentioned the TiVo Stream 4K as causing some of that, but since you probably don't own one, it's probably not doing that. But, again, better that it should resolve itself without a fundamental answer than that it shouldn't resolve itself. Although, as I've mentioned, I'm just like you. I really like to know exactly why things do and do not do the things they're supposed to. But, thanks for letting us know about that. I'm glad to hear that your ghost of a TV is not ghosting you anymore.
Yes, that is true. And I have another item to mention on the net when we've gone around and taken care of all the other questions.
Okay, Ken, I'll put you back at the bottom of the list, which is only remaining person is Sam, and we'll come back to you then. Okay, very good. So, Sam, KD2NSJ, what's your question tonight?
Yeah, first, good evening, Roy. I miss talking to you. I'm okay. I was just under the weather a little bit. My question is, when I'm getting ready to get on to HF, I looked up three antennas, and I just want to know your suggestion, not to tell me, a wire, a beam, or a vertical. I read about each one of them. I've got a basic idea. But if I had to pick one for me, a new starter, what would you suggest?
Well, you could make a case for either. I think personally, the less problematic one would be the vertical. Beams are very good. They have a higher gain, but they're very directional. And so you have to deal with the direction. You do that by adding a complication, a rotator. Rotators are great, but they add to the cost. They add to the consideration of mechanical stressors, and some of them, well, all of them eventually fail, but some fail earlier than others. So in one system, you have an immobile vertical that doesn't move around. There's less reasons for it to fail. And on the other side, you have a beam that can fail by the rotator. The rotator needs a controller, And if you point it in the wrong direction, it's possible to miss contacts. So if I was suggesting to a person with their first HF antenna, I would tend to tell them to go with a vertical first before you start to play around. Yagis are very useful beams, very useful, but they're more complicated. They're more prone to problems. And, you know, it's just easier for a new guy in the hobby to deal with an inanimate vertical.
Two Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
I remember early in my early days as a ham radio operator. I mean, everything you said about beams with the rotators and the towers and the corrosion and blah, blah, blah is all true. But I remember turning that rotator and seeing what I could get in another direction. In other words, you know, can I pull in South Africa by turning that beam, you know, a certain way, or South America or whatever was half the fun of it. I used to love being able to hear a signal go from an S1, you know, to an S4 or 5 because I was turning a beam around. It was so much part of the hobby for me. I miss it a lot. Back to that.
Okay, I mean, that's understandable, Rich, but again, you know, back in those days, we were all younger, you were spryer, the rotator is not quite working right, you could climb up someplace and give it a couple of whacks, you know, we're all getting a little older, and we can't climb that high.
Well, I can't... You know, there used to be beams that were on towers, on roofs that were, the towers were 4 feet high. Do you remember those? They were just right off the roof. And I guess those guys couldn't put up or wanted to put up anything higher, but they were pretty low. And there used to be a lot of them, I remember, that were maybe 4 feet high. But still, you know, climbing up on a slanted roof like that isn't any fun at any age. Go ahead, listen to me. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, there were more than a few models, or they called them roof towers, and they were, you know, some of them were built to kind of be connected to the peak. Others were designed for flat roof design. The point is that I think that Sam would like the most nuisance-free antenna possible. And all things being equal, you know, non-moving antennas break less than moving antennas. And so although, once again, I agree with you that there's a lot of charm in a directable, a high-gain beam, when I started out, and I don't have the environment for a beam, really. So all of my antennas are stationary design. But, you know, I could understand why you would appreciate a directional beam. I mean, at one point I had a receiving magnetic loop that's supposed to be directional, but in the location that I had to put it, it was not terribly directional. I bought a rotator and rotated all over the place and couldn't really perceive a significant front-to-back gain. So in the end, I just stopped using the rotator. But again, perfect world. We should all have towers with phased arrays stacked one on top of the other, but we don't live in a perfect world.
The answer is vertical or digital. At least it is for me. So, thanks, Roy.
You're welcome, Rich. Sam, any thoughts on this subject? Any particular vertical you're interested in, and what kind of bands are you interested in? Right now, I believe you're a technician, so, you know, as far as voice communication, you're kind of stuck with 10 meters. So, Are you thinking of something more 10-meter based or broader based than that?
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, guys. Oh, my God, my brain is spinning. I'm soon to take my general, but I'm thinking, you know, like I can do 10 meters, the bottom part of 10 meters. So I'm just thinking 10, 20, or 40, you know, where everybody usually goes. I'm not thinking about the whole band. You know, just a few of them that everybody goes on when they do a lot of talking. And, the other thing was, Roy, thank you. I'm going with the Virgo. I don't know which you can suggest that also, and I could get that. What was the downside of a wire? Because they're so inexpensive. What's the downside?
Well, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder. I am a big fan of wire antennas. Because you only gave me a choice of a directional beam and a vertical, I chose the vertical. If you would have probably offered me the choice between a vertical and a wire, as long as you have real estate to do it, I think it is a lot less trouble and a lot cheaper to run a wire antenna than a vertical. Depends. Especially for multi-band situations, verticals start to get expensive. They use different little tricks. They use traps and stubs and all kinds of fun stuff. Where it tends to be, again, more simpler with a wire. You can choose an end-fed wire. End-fed wires only require two mounting points. You have to protect from too much RF getting into your shack. And you need an antenna tuner to make up for the mismatches and non-resonance. But a lot of people use end-feds. I'm sure if you've listened to past tech nets, a lot of people discuss their balance and how they ground it and all kinds of things. If you have 3 points of contact, you might want to consider using a dipole. There's a whole bunch of different ways of running a dipole. You can run a resonant dipole for a given frequency. You can run a fan dipole, which is a number of different lengths built on the same basic structure. So you still need three points of attachment. You can build an off-center dipole and then have an antenna tuner to make up for the other bands. You can put up a non-resonant doublet, which looks like a dipole, but it isn't designed for any particular resonance, and it's fed by open wire instead of coax, so the loss due to mismatch is very low, and then tune it with an antenna tuner in your shack. So there's a whole bunch of different options you have with wire antennas.
I think I want to go with the wire. I was drawing up a design for it for the roof, for the length of my house, and I was going to buy two bookshelf brackets, you know? And you put the bookshelf bracket on the roof, and you run the wire in between the two of them, the whole length of the house. And it's much easier, cheaper, and we're going to get a tuner anyway when I get ready. But I like the idea of the wire because then I don't have a problem with neighbors either looking and seeing this big antenna all of a sudden shoot up, you know. The wire is on the roof and you can't see it at the back of the house. So I can get a good wire that can go from 6 to 40 meters. So I'm glad you talked about the wire. I didn't know it was that efficient. And thank you all the guys that had advice. And Roy, I'm always listening to you.
Well, thanks, Sam. I wish you good luck. Please, when you get on the air with it, come back and tell us which variety you finally decided upon and how you're finding it performing.
You know, Roy, because I'm going over 10 minutes to talk to you on Sunday morning. I really miss you. I can't get you. I have 10 meters on this radio like we talked about, there's no upper or lower side pad. So I really missed out buying this expensive Yeti suit. But that's because I didn't do enough homework. So, and I like the idea you, I don't want to tie it up, but you mentioned a 71. Was that the radio? Is that a good start radio?
Do you mean the ICOM IC7100?
Yes, I was reading about it. Is that a good beginner's radio?
Personally, I think it's a great beginner's radio. It was my first desktop radio, and I'm using it right now as you listen. It has given me no problems. I gave it some problems, but it gave me no problems for the 10 years that I've been licensed. And I recommend it very much. It's an all-in-one. It does UHF, VHF, and all the HF bands. So, yeah, I think it would be a wonderful. And it's not that terribly expensive. You know, I don't know what you think expensive might be. They sell now, last time I looked, for $800, which I think is reasonable. It's a 100-watt transmitter for HF. For VHF, it's a little bit below 50, and I think UHF is 35 watts.
Bravo Zulu?
Yes, Rich.
One better than you have in months. I don't know what changed, if anything. Maybe just propagation, but you really sound good about just 20% noise, something like that.
Okay, not doing anything different. I mean, my mode of getting in was going directly with my 35 watts of UHF to our UHF repeater and then having Lou link it through IRLP. But I put together my RM Italy amplifier, and I'm throwing about a little bit above 150 watts in the general direction of the repeater, and that's what's getting me through right now. I'm really, really looking forward to when the grown-up, the big replacement antenna gets placed, so I won't have to use this because it heats up after a while. For these segments, it's not a problem, but I find that when I do the science talk and I'm reading articles and it's almost 100% duty cycle, that thing gets a little toasty.
Well, unfortunately, you have to go to 100 watts, but that's what they were designed for. And as long as, and I know you, that your SWR is looking okay, there's no real long-term, I don't think, damage to the radio or whatever, or using up a little more power. But that's about it. But anyway, it sounds good.
Well, thank you, Rich. Yeah, I don't think it does anything bad to the radio, but amplifiers, you know, this particular amplifier is not really designed for, you know, being driven with 50% power. So it's kind of an all or nothing thing. So the magic is based on the duty cycle. If you talk half the time, you give it enough recovery time to cool down. But if I hit the trigger and run my mouth endlessly with 100% duty cycle that FM does, that's a lot of power that it has to dissipate. So I have a heat sensing fan right above it to dissipate some of the heat. That just means that I can hear the fan kick in when it's toasty.
Okay, Roy, thank you so much. It has a built-in tuner also on that radio, so that's what I liked about it. I don't have to buy an extensional, another one. All right, and thank you, everybody. Roy, thank you so much. KD2NSJ.
Okay, I wish you all the luck in the world, Sam. I just need to correct you. The 7100 does not have a built-in tuner. The ICOM sells an antenna tuner that's built to interface with it, and third-party companies sell antenna tuners that can be used that are much less expensive, but it itself is not built in with an antenna tuner.
Okay, that's what I was reading. It said something about add-ons, and I didn't understand. I thought it meant it was added on to the radio. That add-on is what you're talking about. All right. I'll be all set. Let me get this general down. KQ-NFJ.
AC2GS. Well, all my wishes to you, Sam. I can't wait to hear that you got your general ticket, and I can't wait for you to join us on the 10-meter net. And for people out there who haven't played around with 10 meters lately, it's starting to actually open up. Yesterday was, an IARU contest, and there had to be about six or seven conversations going on. This morning when I usually run my 10-meter net, things were a little bit quiet because the contest had ended a few hours earlier, but there were still three, four conversations. We talked to people from Missouri, Illinois, Florida. We even heard a little bit of a wisp from Puerto Rico. So 10 meters is coming back to life. So if you have the ability, please check it out.
Okay, yeah, I know my friend KD2BDW and his group that, you know, I sign on with for information. They were talking on 10 meters, like you said, and Texas came in and everything. They do a polo, you know, park on the air. They do that tour. And the contest was on the other day. He just said that Europe just took over. I mean, it came in loud and strong. But yes, you're right. 10 meters is open. All right, I don't want to tie it up. Thank you, everybody, for their patience. I'm clear.
Okie doke, Sam. Ken, it's your turn again.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Roy. I was also in the IARU contest. And this is the first contest that I ever remember that I made contact on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters. I was down in the CW portion, and not on 10, but on a few of the other bands, my waterfall was just full of stations. Anyhow, that's not what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about the remote control of your house lighting system. I started out, I guess, like most people did with X10 and discovered that eventually it just, without putting a bridge over the two phases of the power, it just didn't reach far enough. I researched it and went to the folks at Insteon, which use both 900 megahertz radio and also carrier current. The problem I'm having is that the controller for the Insteon stuff seems to have a life of about 3 years. I started in 2012, had to replace it in 2015, replaced it again in 2018, and now it's 2021, and once again, my USB to Insteon stuff has failed, and the problem is this gadget is $80 to $100. So I'm looking, I guess, to get input on what people are using to do home control systems, and have software turn on their outside lights at sundown or whatever. AC2GS, WB2KWC.
W2BZ.
Yeah, Rich, you want to say something?
I've just spent the last 4 days getting used to Echo Dot from Amazon. That, with what they call smart plugs and smart bulbs, can do anything but give you shampoo that you wanted to do, control any lights. I don't know about outside if they have anything that's weatherproof, if that's what you need, but for indoors, there's nothing this technology can't do. It's just amazing. And it's all voice activated. Well, not all voice activated. Either you can use your cell phone to turn lights on or off, or to dim them at a certain time. It actually can dim the lights from 5 to 7 o'clock, if that's when you want them to start to dim. It's called Echo Dot from Amazon.
Okay, that sounds interesting. I'm wondering how flexible the programming is. Right now I've got the software on a desktop machine. I can say, do these things, Monday morning I want the lights to go on at 5:30, or the first Monday of the month I want them to go on at 5:30. I also want to be able to program the lights relative to sunrise and sunset, things like that. The software I like very much, but from Insteon, but the hardware I'm losing faith in.
Well, this will either work from your cell phone. You can do anything you just mentioned and much more. Anything you can think of, you can do, actually. Or you can do it through the Echo Dot itself, OkiFuck. So you could either program it with your voice by saying, turn on my lights from 6 to 8 or whatever, and make them blue, or you can do it through your cell phone.
Okay, I'm looking to do a lot of this stuff when I'm simply not near the house. I'm looking to say, hey, I'm going to be away for the next 2 weeks. Turn on my lights at sundown minus 10 minutes and stuff like that. Basically, the systems that you're describing seem like I need to control them. I want to schedule them when my phone is nowhere near the house.
Easily. The only problem I had, the learning curve's a little steep, because you actually need two programs. You need the Alexa program to control the dot. It's called DOT. But you also need a program to control the lights. It works with two programs on your, or I should say apps on your phone. And that's all you need. You can do it from anywhere.
Okay, doing it from anywhere, can it be autonomous? Can I create one program, which is my calendar for the year, and not basically put it on a system? I don't know. My phone, I don't know. The phone is nowhere near the house, does not always have internet. I'm looking to put it, I guess, on a system that's left at the house that I can program for a year.
Well, it's the dot that remembers what you program. So if you say every day, except Thursday, turn my lights off and on at 6 a.m. and 7 a.m., it'll remember that. So all you have to do is do it as once. Go ahead. It's a little, like I said, the learning curve is a little steep, because you're really dealing with two apps. I thought you were only dealing with one app. One's called Alexa. When you say Alexa, there are these woke words. One's Alexa. One is Echo, and the other one is computer. You say those words before you say the commands you want to give it, and it'll do the commands. And I forget, there are, 100,000 commands by now. This